Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Your Booked. I'm Daisy Buchanan, your host, book inspector and literary dirtbag. I'm currently reading and adoring a proof of Paige Toon's brilliant new book, You Go Anywhere, which is coming in May. I was enjoying it so much that I didn't want to stop while I ate lunch, and now I have a bookmark made of mayonnaise. My brand new book, The Sisterhood, A Love Letter to the Women Who Shaped Me, is published by Headline and it's available online and from bookshops all across the UK. Now to this week's guest, the poet, essayist and broadcaster Sinead Gleeson. Sinead is a writer's reader and a reader's writer. I've lost count of the number of times she's come up in conversation with other authors who are fans of her work and feel indebted to her as she is such a generous champion of theirs. She's edited and contributed to a great volume of anthologies. She was a vital voice in the Repeal the Eighth campaign and she's the author of the brilliant new book Constellations, an essay collection and the story of a life in a body as it goes through sickness, health and motherhood. Constellations is dazzlingly, shatteringly insightful. Sinead breaks our assumptions about womanhood and rebuilds them into something beautiful, vivid and true. This is one of the most personal books I have ever read and one of the most universal. We can all learn from her words and become better humans from them. And her writing is so gorgeous that you can't tear your eyes from the page. It will stay with me forever. I read a proof, fell in love and begged Sinead's publicist to let us get her on the podcast. We ended up at her house in Dublin, drinking wine and hanging out with one of the most adorable puppies in publishing.
Because I turn I'll make us some more tea in a minute when your voice, your voice starts going to say you want more tea or something.
Thank you so much.
Do you want another cup before we start?
I think I'm all right.
Sure?
Do you need anything?
Yeah. No, I'm good. Yeah, I'm good.
So we're here in Sinead's house in Dublin. It's beautiful. We're here with Jake the dog. Hello. Jake is going for a little wander. I think he wants to see what we're going to do. So you were just showing me Niven Govindan's new book, which is... Ah, there it is. I found it. Put it on the sofa. This Brutal House.
Yeah.
Published by
it's
Dialogue.
Published by Dialogue, which is and one of the people, it's an imprint of Little Brain, I think, and there's a wonderful woman called Charmaine Lovegrove who's doing wonderful things and trying to find...
Oh, I love her on Twitter.
Yeah, she's fabulous. Trying to find BAME writers and writers of colour and sort of, I suppose, lifting up voices that we don't necessarily get to see or hear, and we all know that publishing can be very white and homogenous, and so I think this is a really good thing. But I interviewed Niven. I got to know his work. We had him on the book show a few years ago, and I think it was which book was it? You mentioned one actually. We're the
New
Romantics.
I think I read
it. Was
his...
Black Bread, White Beer?
Yes.
I think we talked
that
about
was the,
all
the
days
Friday Project book. I think.
Yeah. So I think he's really talented. So this is like, it's about the kind of the Vogue ball kind of drag groups in New York in the '70s. I think it sounds absolutely fabulous and wonderful. So I'm going to dive into that, and it says like, I mean, echoes of James Baldwin, Marilyn Robinson and Rachel Kushner. I mean, you could not read that.
I know. So, it sounds magnificent.
Yeah, so that's out. I think that's out in, is it June? I think it's June. Yeah, but this is, the as we were saying, the problem with like so many proofs. There's so, all the things you want to read, all the things you maybe have to read for work reasons, in your case, in my case. And I just wish sometimes I had a robot version of me that I could just feed books into it and let it do it for me.
Wouldn't that be heaven if you could just download them directly into your brain?
Yeah, instantly. But which of course goes against all the kind of ideas of why we love reading and the things we like about it, whether that's, you know, on a plane or in the bath or in stages or savouring another chapter before a book is finished because you don't want it to end. But yeah, it would be handy though.
It would be nice.
If all the work reading was done that way and your pleasure reading was just for yourself, it would be great.
What sort of reader were you when you were young? Were you a child who loved books, or was there a particular book that was a real gateway for you?
Yeah, I was a massive, massive reader, and like everybody else, started with the usual stuff. So it was all the kind of Ina Blyton and Five Fine Doubters and Secret Seven, all that stuff. And then I suppose because that stuff was mystery stuff, it isn't really a shocker that I moved on to very quickly to Agatha Christie. And I think actually there's some over here.
Oh, the,
yeah. I have piles of these, but this is only a couple. So, especially the old ones. I love them. They're these old kind of...
These editions are beautiful.
I think they're... Fontana. That's a Fontana. That's an old Penguin.
So, The Murder of Roger Ackroyd. That's a real kind of Penguin Books green.
This is
The Murder on the Links?
The Murder on the Links. So, it's a golf murder. So, you can see the kind of plus fours.
Is that a 70s? But it looks very 70s.
Yeah, very 70s. And then Why Didn't They Ask Evans? That's got another golf ball.
Yeah.
Isn't it golf in Agatha Christie now that I look at it? But they were always...
the P.G. Woodhouse of murders.
But you know what? I just opened this actually, and this shop, Como's, used to be on Cork Street, which is in Dublin 8, and it was a really tiny kind of windowless dark shop that this kind of man who always had like a fag hanging out the corner of his mouth and you just walk in and there were just floor to ceiling piles, and I used to go down there, and I think I even walked down there on crutches once, and he got to know that it was me, and he'd be like, they're over there, and he would know. So before I was like Nancy Drew and Hardy Boys, and then I progressed to these, so I bought a lot of books in that shop, and some of the stuff, there's an essay in Consolations about spending a lot of time in hospital in my teens. So at that point, I think by the time I was 12, 13, I'd read all the Agatha Christie. And then it was like Ellery Queen and Marsh. And
you'd read all the Agatha Christie.
Yeah,
bloody
yeah,
hell.
Yeah, but this is the thing. When you're in hospital and you're immobile and you've got nothing else to do. And also I'd be clicking away on my phone probably now. But there's nothing else to do. So when you're if you're ill or kind of not able to move around that much, or you're bedbound, reading is it's total gateway. It takes you, gets rid of the boredom, it passes the time, but also like lets you roam around in a way that you physically can't when you're, you know, on traction or whatever it was. So I read so much when I was younger, and I think it was a lot of it was kind of crime stuff. And then when I got kind of into my teens, I started to think about, you know, maybe I suppose literary stuff, and started to like the, you know, those wonderful Penguins. I wonder if these kind of ones, do you remember these ones? These minty kind of ones. So I started to read this sort of stuff, like Jean Rhys and Colette, not understanding all of it, but kind of going, ooh, these look interesting and fabulous. And as we were talking about earlier, short. Look how short that is. If only all books were like, how many pages is that? 135 pages? That's kind of quite a nice sort of length.
In your teens, I think that's a perfect time to start reading Jean Rhys, because that there's a real bleakness to her that I think can be quite terrifying when you're adult enough to realise how bleak the world really is.
Yeah.
And you've got sort of a teen idea of it, almost like a... In the way that I think, you know, why teenagers love the Smiths, I think, is why he'd be drawn to that world.
I think the other thing about reading at that age is that you're like an omnivore. So you haven't learned what your tastes are. You don't believe in ditching books. You literally read everything and anything. I used to, my dad always had, I mean, growing up, my mum read all the kind of Catherine Cooks and stuff, and there wouldn't have been a kind of lot of literary books in my house. And my dad doesn't read that much, but he was really into kind of ghost stories and spooky stories. So he had these kind of, Alfred Hitchcock used to do these collections like Bar the Doors and Ghostly Gallery, and they had like really trippy kind of covers, and I loved them. But he had there's a set of these books. I don't know if you've ever seen these. There was like Irish Tales of Terror, Scottish Tales of Terror.
It's just a frog. It's one of the most frightening books I've ever seen. Emerging from the mist.
I wondered, is this like some sort of guitar pegs? But then I kind of thought, if it's Irish, is that a harp? Is that a frog on a harp?
Looks like it could almost be a bed, like a board at the bottom of the bed, and the frog.
I thought it was something musical, but also I don't know what he's doing. But this, I don't know why a frog is meant to mean this is a terrifying book. But they were just kind of ghost stories.
I'm scared.
And they'd have like, you know, some of the people in them were sort of, so Sheridan Le Fanu, obviously, who's quite famous ghost story writer, Melmoth Maturin, obviously, there's Sarah Perry's connection to that, who's an Irish writer. Also, horrifyingly, you'll look at this and go, are there any women in this book? No, no, there are no women in this book, which is a frequent thing that happens with the Irish anthologies of yore. But I love this kind of stuff. So a lot of ghost stories and spooky stuff and gothic stuff. So again, it was obviously not a hop, skip and a jump to like Wuthering Heights and those kind of things where, you know, books that, again, that are, especially in terms of setting and place, just take you away. And as you mentioned, like Jean Rhys, you're reading like these, and Colette even, you're reading these very kind of like avant-garde, sort of strange, mystical, promiscuous sort of lives. And if you're reading that as a teenage girl in Catholic Ireland in the, you know, the 80s and 90s, it feels very, very far away from where you are. And that's what books are meant to do. Mm. They're meant to bring you to an opposite kind of experience or a different kind of life to the one that you have.
That must have been truly mind-expanding.
Yeah, yeah, especially, I mean, everyone kind of, you know, I think, oh God, I've forgotten Judy Blume. I mean, the Judy Blume books were huge for me as well. And I think, you know, everybody read Forever, and that was often for a lot of people the first time that you read about sex in a book. Or, you know,
was there any kind of censorship of that? Were they quite hard to get hold of?
Judy Blume, no, not by that point, but there still were. I mean, we talk about like Edna O'Brien, obviously, with the Country Girls trilogy from the 60s, which is a wonderful collection. And it's the one city, one book choice for Dublin this year. And those books, when you read them now, I mean, they're quite tame, but they were considered, like, I mean, the book was burned in the local church grounds in Limerick, where Edna was from. And I think it was not even that it was that sexual or that explicit, but it showed women kind of making choices, wanting to be with men, not wanting, crucially, to get married, wanting to have another life that wasn't just being a mother by the time you're 19 and having three babies. And I think that's what annoyed the church in a lot of ways, because it's not that terribly explicit in lots of ways. But yeah, I think, I mean, there's a wonderful writer who's in the long gaze back, Nora Holt. There's a couple of her books here, who only died in the 1980s, and I think is a really, really transgressive Irish writer. And
yeah, it's all right, pull this one out because this looks beautiful.
Yeah, Cocktail Bar. So that's there's a story from that in the long gaze back, and there's they actually, being in the long gaze back, a lot of people started to ask about her and talk about her, and she's so, so forgotten. She was more banned than Edna O'Brien and John McGahern, who were both banned quite a bit. And I included a story in that book, and then the publisher who'd published this collection said, why don't we reissue this book, Cocktail Bar? So I wrote the introduction, and then
I was looking in this original edition of Cocktail Bar, so probably not in that one.
There's one, it's somewhere around here, I'll find it in a bit. But it is also about how easily women get forgotten, and there's a story that's not in this collection called 9 Years is a Long Time. It was written in the 1940s in Ireland, and it's about a couple who were married, and you find out as you read the story that basically the woman takes gentleman callers for money with the husband's approval. And it's to write a story like that in the 40s in Ireland is just, no wonder she was getting in trouble all the time and was being watched. But also, I think some people have a theory that some of her work was quite romantic, and the same thing that can happen to Daphne du Maurier. If you write romantic stuff and it happens to be literary, you get dismissed just for being romantic, and people forget all the really brilliant writing that you did.
Oh, I'm going to put Cocktail Bar back because
There's lots of bits of Demare. There's one,
excuse me,
my obsession with Virago.
Oh, these lovely ones. Virago editions.
The hardbacks. So that's the short stories. There are the Don't Look Now short stories. The House on the Strand. There's another version of The Birds. Oh, how many editions of The Birds do I have? My God, look at that.
Another really chilling.
And also Pam, who published loads of those old Agatha Christies. So also these kind of trippy
70s. 70s Pam books are just gorgeous. Yeah.
So it's just a bird with a beak and a broken glassy window looking kind of evil. But I love it.
What I love as well about that bird is it's obviously just bird detail, but it looks like it might be wearing a sort of one of those like flying hats.
I think actually it looks more like a penguin than a bird that can actually fly, does it not? Yeah, it does. But the mouth is open.
Do you think the brief is a bit broad?
I think it was. Angry bird hammering on a window. Go for it. Knock yourself out. I think there's a bit of that.
And I've seen a book that I love that I don't see often, Jane Bowles, Two Serious Ladies, because that's quite a, in terms of what is happening and all of the intrigue and the sexual politics, that's...
It's a phenomenal book.
I think ahead of its time. Well, not ahead of its time, but it's about subjects that weren't readily discussed.
No, not at all. And then these two really interesting women, and the title is also a real oxymoron of that, you know, they're not serious at all in a lot of ways. And their regard and their connection with each other, I think, is really striking. And again, there's a sort of a a thing about that book that you, when you meet people who like it, they love it with all their heart, and you don't often meet people who like it. There's a friend of mine who's a Canadian writer, Patrick DeWitt. It's one of his all-time favourite books, and he's like, I wish I'd read this a long time ago, and he absolutely adores it. So I love talking to people who've read it. And again, I actually, there's some stuff on these shelves here that I really want to read this, reread this year, and I'm not a massive rereader because I always think, what is it, some book I'm not reading that is amazing and going to change my life, and I wasted my time reading something again. But I'm coming around to the idea of rereading more because I think you miss things.
If I were to come now and grant you the magic present of a week off from all responsibilities, all writing and work and childcare, everything's sorted, but it's like you can read any book you like, but it has to be a book that you've read before. What would that book be?
Oh, that's really hard. Do you know what I think it might be? Because I do love this book and I want to reread it for loads of reasons, and because I think I'm probably going to teach it to students. This is a writer who I think is phenomenal and has a new book out this year, Evie Wilde. Her first book has an amazing title. It's called After the Fire, A Still Small Voice. But this is a book called All the Birds Singing. And it's about a woman, starts off a woman on the Isle of Wight, and one of her sheep has been killed. She lives on her own. It's very mysterious and atmospheric. And you're like, is something watching her? Is something stalking her? And then it cuts back to another story, a dual story in Australia. So the one story is told linear frontwards and the other story is told backwards. And I can't, it's such a clever way of telling a story, but she's just a beautiful, I just can't think of anyone who writes like her, and I love her work, and there's a new novel I think coming out in the autumn, and I keep telling people about her to read her, and you know yourself as well, lots of stuff gets pushed your direction in terms of what you should read and who you should read, and I always love hearing about people that are strange or unusual, or that's my dog just looking for attention there. I don't know what he's at.
Jack, who's quite upset. Jack, I'll be asking you about your...
Jake,
I'm so sorry. That's Jake.
He has about 15 names, as I was saying, so he's quite happy with all of them. He's kind of multi-name. He's okay with that. But
Jake, I will be asking you about the book that you'd reread shortly.
I would probably read this. Also, a book I love that I actually have reread because I do love it. And again, you might know this because it's a feminist classic, which is The Awakening by Kate Chopin.
Oh, wow, yes.
People kind of read that in the same, around the same time as they read The Yellow Wallpaper, which is the Charlotte Perkins Gilman. And this is just a book, you know, written in the, I think, 1899 it was published, so it was the decade of the new woman, so lots of stuff was happening.
I love
with women.
That very much looks like an edition you get if you're doing it as a set text.
Yeah, it's one of those, it's, you know, these Dover thrift things, like they're often like 99p or whatever, but again, crucially very short and small, but it is about a woman who makes really unconventional choices when she's expected to be married and have children and just, you know, shut up and just be a lady and don't do things that are transgressive, but of course she ignores all that and does all the transgressive things, and I totally love it, so I'd love to reread that again, because again, I've seen stuff in it that you don't spot. And again, what we were saying, when you read things when you're a teenager, you don't understand everything. And I think it's, you know, reading a book like that, particularly now, at a time where there's a lot of talk around, you know, motherhood and not having children or having children, or Me Too and rape culture and all the sort of things, horrifying, the long list of horrifying things that happen to women in the world. To read a book like that, I think, is to see how it stands up after over 100 years.
Definitely, because I have not read it in many, many years. Yeah. And I was a bit kind of, you know, utterly transported by it, but we've sold all this now, like reading it for the story rather than necessarily the resonance of the story. And I think it'd be so much there too.
Yeah. What do you think, without giving it away, what do you think of the ending? Can you remember the ending? If I say it's something to do with swimming, does that jog any memories? Because the ending, I think, really divides a lot of people about what's going on or what she decides to do with her life.
If my memory serves me, not to do any spoilers, I remember feeling quite cross-abashed at the time, but perhaps it making more sense to me now as a very human choice.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I was like, oh no, I didn't like that at all. And then I think as I've thought about it, as the years go on, I'm much more accepting of it. But then isn't that good when a character makes you annoyed? Because then you're like, oh, I'm so annoyed because I feel really real to you.
Yeah, it's a very authentic thing to do.
Yeah.
Are there any, I feel bad about asking this question, but I was thinking about this, you know, problematic romantic heroes and all of those narratives and what we're sort of sold as being the ideal relationship and thinking, well, this is just terrible. Are there any male characters who are presented as romantic heroes that you have problematic crushes on?
Oh, problematic crushes.
Jane Bowles lives here.
Yes, she does. Let me think. Oh,
I don't think I ever really fancied Heathcliff.
No, I didn't. And I see this is a thing that kind of pops up, a meme type thing on Twitter, and I kind of go, yeah, I don't think I've ever really fallen in. I mean, I've rooted for characters, but I don't think I've fallen in love with one necessarily. Well, you know, it's funny, actually, now that we're, because we've been talking about Du Maurier, there's something really, and it's maybe it's something to do with Laurence Olivier. Rebecca, what's his name?
Maxime?
That's it.
Is it there?
Yeah, no, it's not. It's not.
That's cheating, Producer Dale.
No, it's somewhere. I think it might be upstairs. There's some Rebecca's here, and I think or there's some Du Maurier here. But yeah, I mean, it's because he's sort of, and yet he's got that gaslighty vibe about him, which is really problematic, obviously. But I tend to root for characters and wonder how they're going to. I like to see, as we all kind of tend to do, you want to see how a character's going to respond to a certain problem in the hope that maybe if you ever presented with that situation, you'll steal their ideas and their roots out of things and see what they do with it. But
I think, isn't it? Shouting at a telly quiz show, not really appreciating how pressured that situation is.
Yeah, completely.
Who would you write a new ending for or write a sequel for if it's someone you rooted for and you really wanted them to have a happy ending?
Do you know, it's funny, I think this is also a book I think a lot of people love, Toni Morrison's Beloved, and it's such, this book absolutely blew my mind the first time I read
it. Gorgeous, gorgeous edition.
I just noticed it's Picador. That it's such an angry book, and as you obviously you find the terrible thing happens, there's a ghost, there's a ghost of a baby, there's terrible things happen in this book, and I can remember feeling that I could smell the spaces that they talk about, and I could literally the tang of blood and metal would be in the air. So I kind of feel, but everybody in this book is deeply unhappy, and I suppose a next chapter, if the next chapter is not as horrifying as the first one, but the idea that like that slavery is such an awful thing that so many things still have to be worked out and figured out about, and it happened, and worse things in slavery happened even more so to women in lots of cases, which is kind of one of the building blocks of the story. So maybe a sort of a different story where what happens to the baby doesn't happen to the baby, and there's a different kind of life. I wondered if, I mean, I don't think Toni Morrison would ever go back at this stage, but I love this book so much, and I think you could have written a book based on all the characters in it if you gave them all their own story, because again, she's so brilliant at characterization and bringing people to life. And this book kind of chilled me. I loaned it to somebody not that long ago, actually, who hadn't read it and just said they found it really like more of a ghost story. They found it to be actually quite frightening as opposed to just terrorizing or traumatic. They said I was actually kind of a bit freaked out reading the book.
It's a book I've read a long, long, long time ago.
Yeah. I think that everything that's happened in the US, you know, with Black Lives Matter and police brutality and all, and again, we're seeing it represented in TV shows and in films and books and in music, and rightly so. And I just think that we didn't know the half of it such a long time ago, whether that's through ignorance or that, you know, lack of internet, lack of news, or you wouldn't hear other cases being reported. But I just think and this is a really important thing for people to look at their own bookshelves as well, and kind of make sure that your bookshelves look that there are people of colour, that there are queer people, that there are people of different abilities, that there aren't too many. I mean, you know, I remember a guy tweeting me about his bookshelves. This was a while ago. And I did scan. I didn't see one woman on the shelves. And again, it alarms me if people are only reading one kind of thing, or you're not reading outside of your own experience or your own culture. Your reading is going to be a lot duller and your world a lot smaller if you're not kind of checking that. So it's really, I mean, there's a wonderful book around here that, again, there's a famous list. David Bowie has a list of 100 books that he loved, and there's a book on it. It's probably around here. Oh, there he is, actually. There is actually Cocktail Bar, that one.
Introduction by Sinead Gleeson.
It's called Passing by Nella Larson, which is about where light-skinned women of colour and the idea of whether you want to try and pass as white. And it's a really political, small, dark book. There's another book in the same edition I have called Quicksand. And again, it's books like this. I think of like, here it is here. And it's actually beside one of my all-time favourite writers, which is Zora Neale Hurston. If people ask me about, whenever I'm asked, do you have a favourite line from a book, favourite first line, I always pick Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Are Watching God. It has one of the best opening paragraphs with best opening lines ever, ever, ever. This introduction, I think, is actually by, if I'm not mistaken, I think it's by Zadie Smith, who is, it's wonderful. She's written brilliantly about her.
It's in Feel Free, I think, right?
It is in Feel Free, yeah, which is one of my favourite collections of essays.
Love
she's just
that.
A book so essay
much.
Goddess. I adore her.
If you want to read the whole paragraph, we would love that.
Are you sure? Okay. Ships at a distance have every man's wish on board. For some, they come in with the tide. For others, they sail forever on the horizon, never out of sight, never landing until the watcher turns his eyes away in resignation, his dreams mocked to death by time. That is the life of men. Now, women forget all those things they don't want to remember and remember everything they don't want to forget. The dream is the truth. Then they act and do things accordingly. It's a wonderful book as well because of it's written in a very specific kind of vernacular as well, which takes you a while to get into, but it has a gorgeous kind of musicality and rhythm to it. But yeah, that book absolutely blew my mind the first time I read it. And I'd love to, yeah. And then she had a really sad life as well. I mean, died kind of pauperish and penniless. And
how would you sort of go about that if there was someone who perhaps hadn't read for a while and was really struggling to get back into it? And if you want to say, look, this is going to feel a bit hard and a bit uncomfortable at first, and it's a lot to get used to, but stick with it.
Like a book for someone who hasn't been reading.
Or someone who's maybe been reading a very within a particular area and something where, you know, you want to say, look, this is, you should read this. And at first it will feel quite difficult, but then the payoffs are great.
Well, not necessarily difficult. And again, I know I have a couple of editions of this, if I can find it. Yeah, I have. There's one over there as well, which is one of my all-time favourite writers, which is Laurie Moore, who's better known as a short story writer. But this is an incredible book about two teenage girls and their friendship. And one of the women in it is looking back on her life and deals with, you know, youth and promiscuity. And one person has an abortion. But it's also Laurie Moore is really, really comic kind of writer. But what she's doing with words on the page, it's quite a set. You don't realise after a while that she is being quite funny. It is really dark, but she's talking about the most serious. One of her best known short stories is set in oncology, pediatrics ward.
Edition is Who Will Run the Frog Hospital? Yeah, and now all I can think of is that Agatha Christie frog looking quite distressed. Is that a frog on its way to the frog hospital?
Let's get the frog cover back out and compare. I don't know where I put that. But actually, I just noticed, again, because this book is a book that I love, I have another edition of it somewhere around here.
There. 90s. Yeah.
I love this multiple edition.
And they're both Faber, actually, I think. Yeah, they're both Faber. So I really like that cover. But I think, and it's interesting when you get to know a writer. A lot of people will mention Moore as a short story writer, and she has a brilliant line about the short story is an affair. The short story is an affair and the novel is a marriage. And people think of her as a short story writer, but my favourite thing of hers is this novel. And maybe it's because of the first thing I read and I didn't realise it was all these collections of short stories that she had. When people can't or are struggling to read or they don't know what to read, I always suggest something small and quick and sort of quite encyclopedic. And this is a book from a couple of years ago that I really, really liked, called How Life by Robert Seethaler. And it's literally, it's set in a kind of a logging community in America in the early 1900s. And it literally is the story of one man's life told in, you can see, about 150 pages. Like, how can you fit a whole life into 150 pages? And it's a very, what I think a publisher would call a small story. And yet you feel like you're living in this freezing cabin where he lives. And it's just a linear account of a man's life, but things happen because it's fiction. It's not a memoir. And this is the kind of book I've lent to a lot of people who have not been reading because they feel it's doable and it's short and because it is quite, you know, it is one of those things you get pushed onto each page by what happens on the next. And I just totally loved it. I mentioned Patrick DeWitt as well. I've got two brothers and one reads and the other one doesn't really. And my dad's not much of a reader, but I loaned all of them The Sisters Brothers by Patrick DeWitt, which was shortlisted for the Booker. And it's by two brothers who are cowboys and all of them read it and loved it. And it's I think if you get three people, especially two who are not real readers, who love a book like that. So that's the book I kind of say to people, if you don't like this, I'll give you like 50 quid. I'll give you some sort of monetary remuneration. So yeah, so I'd say Patrick DeWitt's The Sisters Brothers is a book you can literally give to any kind of reader and people will just love it.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
We'll be back to Sinead soon, but now it's time for my steal of the week. A book so good that just paying the cover price is a bit like buying a Picasso from a car boot sale for 20 pence and then being all smug on the Antiques Roadshow. This week's steal is by Series 1 guest Nina Stibbe. Her brand new book, Reasons to be Cheerful. If you loved Man at the Helm and Paradise Lodge, of course you did, I have great news. Lizzie Vogel is back and she's exploring the world of semi-legal dentistry. This is such a tender book about being on the very brink of adulthood. Nina isn't just the funniest writer I know, but the most emotionally intelligent too. This made me laugh and laugh and laugh, and then suddenly I was weeping. The shift is exquisitely handled. It's a story about everything that is wonderful and awful about being human. And Nina is such a sonorous, lyrically smart writer of jokes that she makes Coleridge sound like a broken boiler. That's Reasons to be Cheerful, out on the 28th of March, published by Viking. Now back to Sinead.
This is a lot of non-fiction memoir poetry. This is a load of poetry because they're all kind of really skinny. And again, I think this, if people are struggling to read, sometimes I think they assume it has to be a novel or even a book of short stories, which is also a great recommendation for people who don't read much short story collection, or even better, an anthology. Because if you don't like one story, you've only spent 10 pages with it, it doesn't feel like a waste, and you just jump on to the next thing. And I do love them. I mean, I've edited a couple of them, and I love the fact that they're, you don't know what you're going to find. It's a bit of a grab bag. So I tend to buy them. There's a few knocking around over here. There's shelves over there with Irish stuff. But and then these kind of things, like little sets like this, that's my kryptonite. I can't resist that kind of stuff.
Beautiful, these Faber stories.
Yeah, the standalone ones. So they've got
Edna Breen one.
That's an Edna Breen, yeah, from Paradise. And then Sally's one, that was the one from Granta, which is Mr. Salary. Juna Barnes is another writer who was wonderful, who wrote a book called Nightwood, a kind of quite experimental sort of book. And that's a handful of stories, but they're a lovely idea. And there's Beckett, Dante and the Lobster.
Sort of, you know, books as decorative objects as well as books.
Yeah. Do you know that Notting Hill Editions, who published these are all essays and different people. So they've published, like, from Deborah Levy up to, like, there's the one. This one is wonderful. John Day. He used to be a bike courier in London, and it's basically a kind of a psychogeography. What he called it, cyclogeography. So it's kind of all about London, how you traverse a city on a bike and how it's a different speed to a car or walking. And then obviously there's Wolf, and it's wonderful. This is, in terms of books as objects, this is lovely. It's a book about the history of horror, and it's called Sleeping with the Lights On, and there's a cutout of a bulb on the front, which I adore. Daryl's an academic here in Trinity. And these ones, I love these ones. These are object lessons. You pick one subject and you write a book on it. So you may know Joanna Walsh. She used to run the Read Women account. She did hotels. There's ones on shipping containers, dust, personal sock. Stereo, sock.
What would your object be?
I would have written one, I think. Someone's already done it, though. I would have maybe done hair, but I have an essay in my own book about hair. But I don't know. What would yours be? What would you think? It's a great idea. Ooh, like,
that's a good question. Well, it's a bit sort of niche, but I was thinking about, and also just because I've seen there is a hotel one. I was thinking earlier about how I want to write about hotel gyms, because they're almost always completely terrible and they've not got anything you need in there. But also you feel about 1,000 times more sort of virtuous and insufferably smug, because going in a hotel, it's so much more effort somehow than just going to the gym in real life, yeah. even though you're just sort of walking into a basement.
Yeah, when you could just like actually be asleep or in the spa or having a cocktail in the bar instead of being
on
the gym.
Holiday or yeah. away. But
do you know who's actually doing one of these? Do you know Alison Devers, who's opened the Second Shelf bookshop?
Oh, yes.
She's doing one on trains, I believe, this year. Yeah, which is another good one. Because you kind of don't know what people are going to say. It's often not the straightforward. Mm. It's not an account of the object. It's your relationship to the object. But I think a lot of the stuff up here, there's a lot of nonfiction stuff. And again, my book is a book of essays. And I found that for a long time, I thought I was going to write a novel. Because you assume if you're a writer, it's going to be a novel. And I didn't really know, you know, I'd read handfuls of essays over the years, but they hadn't really become a thing, or certainly not you could write a book about. And I started to find, you kind of start to find the writers who are sort of writing stuff that really interests and appeals to you. So people like Maggie Nelson or Rebecca Solnit.
And sometimes I think it's, there's an aspect of permission, isn't there? Oh, you're allowed to write a book about that.
Absolutely. And I think there's a book that was recommended to me a few years ago, which was Leslie Jemison's The Empathy Exams, which is, again, a collection of essays, but it's about all sorts of things. And the title essay, Empathy Exams, is she needs money, so she does medical acting, where you literally go in and you're given a condition and you have to pretend to medical students that you have like a tumour, or you know, you've got appendicitis. But she juxtaposes with, she finds that she has a heart issue. She has to get, I think, some sort of, not quite a pacemaker, but something put in her chest. And then in the same chapter, she has an abortion, so she's talking about her body. And she juxtaposes all these things about the medical world. There's a brilliant essay in it called The Grand Unified Theory of Female Pain, which is about, you know, all the women in literature, like, so Miss Havisham burning in her dress and all this kind of stuff. And it was reading a book like that. It's about a lot of different things, but reading a book like that, I had been sort of writing things like that. And then I kind of went, nobody's going to want to read stuff like this. And then I found Leslie Jemison's book and thought, wow, you can actually do this. And people are doing it. And she's, obviously, I'm nowhere near her league, but she's an incredible, brilliant writer. And I think in the way that's happened in the last few years, there has been a lot of work around medical stuff and around the body and about female bodies and about autonomy. From Roxane Gay's Hunger is around here somewhere, which I also think is a wonderful book. And I think that it is about permission, and it's also about women finding their voices and feeling that you can say things, that's particularly in Ireland, that maybe you wouldn't have said 10 or 12 or 15 years ago.
I really want to talk to you about Constellations, because I know it's bold, because at the time of recording we're in January, and I think technically I read it last year, but I think it is going to be, it's one of the strongest, most powerful and most moving and compelling books of 2019, maybe ever. I truly, truly adored it.
So, and it's funny, that was only ever my working title. Because I was thinking about it, they've kind of gone with the line about the metal in my body, but I thought it was a kind of a really good way of describing an essay collection, because they are all distinct in themselves, but they're all part of something larger.
And kind of, I think, maybe not, we might disagree with this, but about sort of womanhood as well. Yeah. And it's a sort of a galaxy of all these women,
for sure,
very different, but very much part of something universal.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I see, like I said, there are writers who sort of shown me what you can do, and lots of them are not necessarily just fiction writers or people who write essays. So,
did you start writing it before you knew it was a book? Was there a period of time where you realised what it was going to become?
I kind of started to write standalone stuff. You know, it's funny, actually, I keep forgetting this, but a good few years ago, I wrote a tiny, tiny piece about January 5th, which is the anniversary of when I got leukemia. And I used to have a blog, and I put it up on that, and a publisher got in touch with me and said, would you want to write more like this? And I said, I don't know. I had literally never thought about writing memoir or essays. So they gave me a deadline, and I wrote a few pieces, and I really liked writing it. And I think they wanted something else from me. I think they wanted something much more linear and all about the illness, and I wasn't interested in writing some sort of sick lit type book, because I still don't see this book as a memoir, because the book is about a lot of things. To me, Vivian Gornick, who's a wonderful essayist herself and writer, says that, you know, the memoirist tells all and the essayist selects, and I wasn't interested in telling all. And I also think that really good essays look outward. So they look at art and they look at politics and they look at other writers and they look at things going on in the world, as opposed to just constantly talking about their own experience. So I think the first one that I wrote, I was starting to, my husband will, if he was, he'd be laughing right behind me if he was standing closer to me. I talked about writing for a long time and then didn't do it. And a lot of it was fear. and lack of confidence. And because so much of my working life is meeting writers who are writing wonderful books, you kind of think, I'll never be able to do that. It won't be as good. So why would I even bother? So I didn't do it for a long time, but harboured these ambitions. So a new literary journal had started in Ireland with three women as editors called Banshee. It's a wonderful journal. And they set up and were looking for submissions. So I decided to write a piece. So I wrote a piece about hair, which is sort of about my own experience, various head shavings, multiple colours, chemotherapy, but also about, you know, Le Tondu in the Second World War, about PJ Harvey, about Renaissance paintings, about what how hair can make people can make an awful lot of assumptions about women based on their hair. So I submitted it to them and they came back and said they were going to publish it. I generally was really shocked, and I'd actually been in hospital. I had a fall and thought I'd messed up my hip, and I was just really emotional. I think it was a lot of opiates as well. And I just couldn't believe that they were going to publish it. So after that, I thought, well, okay, sometimes all it takes, and I say this to people all the time who are trying to write, if you just get one piece published or you get onto one shortlist, it gives you such a massive injection of confidence where you think, somebody actually thinks it's got some merit. So that you take that and you try and bring it to the next thing. And I think the next thing then was probably the first Granta essay about Lourdes and my hip surgery and patriarchal, terrible male doctors who dismiss women. So I had two or three, and I there was a competition, the Deborah Rogers competition, where they were looking for works in progress. And I had only three essays and I decided to send it in to that. And it was a competition run by this agency, RCW, Rogers, Cohen & White. And I got, there was 890 people, so I got to the last eight. And based on that, my wonderful agent took me on. And even then he was like, so what are you doing here? I was like, I don't know. So I had three essays, loads more on the go, but didn't think that a publisher would be interested or that it could be a book. And if they were all very disparate things, how would it all fit together? And then if it is a collection, an essay collection is a miscellany, so you can put things in, but it's only after as publishers will try and find a connecting theme. But then you see yourself the way, the more of them I wrote, the more I see, actually some of these are in conversation that I didn't expect to be.
It's something that I just, every time I do this and look at a bookshelf, the physicality of the bookshelf versus the sort of ephemeral, the idea that something can be sort of free floating in your head and all the while, because I, you know, whenever I write, I'm like, I'm really not sure this is something that anyone's going to be interested in.
You can't think about the reader. I mean, I know people are like, oh, you have to think about the reader. I can't, because again, a lot of my book is, people have been saying that it's raw and that it's personal. And to me, for it not, if it wasn't, it wouldn't be authentic, and it would have been a waste of my time to kind of try and lie or disguise or hide behind things. But if I had thought about it while I was writing some of that stuff about the reader, I would have absolutely backed off and I would have started to censor and I wouldn't have felt as confident. I have actually, it's funny, I have another friend who's also got hip problems, and when she read that Blue Hills piece, she said to me, oh my God, it's so private and you're so public. And then when she said that, I had a moment of, oh my God, what have I done? And I just thought, because I didn't think of it like that. I thought, is it really? Am I saying something really strange and out there and transgressive? And
I think it's so interesting, people writing about, because it's, I guess, our health is something that is not permanent and not to be taken for granted. And something that I cannot stop thinking about with Constellations is the juxtaposition of you writing about things that happened to you, but also the really tragic, utterly consuming essay about your friend. I don't want to do a spoiler, but the awful, awful accident and the power of that sort of the reality of living in a body. And I guess it's almost like, you know, not like being a logger, but a life is sort of something that all you can do is move forward, and the alternative is a sudden awful stop.
And the thing about that essay, it just started out as, it's called Our Mutual Friend, and it's because for a long time people asked myself, my husband, so how did you meet? And I did have to stop telling the story because I used to find it upsetting. But also the reason why it connects to the rest of the book is because so much of the book is about the fragility of the body, the temporal nature of the body, how easy it can be broken. And, you know, Rob, the friend I talk about in that essay, was never, ever sick. There was never anything wrong with him. He'd never been to hospital or a doctor. And it just takes one thing to happen for your body, for something awful to happen to your body. And I think I think Picador wanted the Blue Hills essay to be first. And I think in a way now I've realized that what it says in the first paragraph of that book, which is the first page of the book, is essentially a lot of what the book is about, which is that you don't ever think about your body unless, you know, you're fighting in a war or you're in hospital or you're having sex or you whatever. It's like good things and bad things. You literally most of the time, day to day, never stop to think about it. And it is that, you know, that cliche about your health being your wealth, that if you're untroubled, by bad health, you don't know how lucky you are to not have to deal with that.
I think it's the most straightforward definition of privilege, isn't it? Yeah. You don't notice how good you have it until you don't have it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's something that I wanted to talk about in the book in relation to not just myself, but particularly in relation to women and what happens to women and what has happened traditionally to women in Ireland, about that, you know, women's bodies here have been the source of, like, you must have 12 or 15 kids. You are not allowed to have an abortion. You're not allowed to go on the contraceptive pill, all based around the dogma of the church and religion, but also, you know, women who are put into mother and baby homes and women who are put into laundries. And we've had a really appalling track record in the way we treat women and their bodies in Ireland. And if you think about it a lot, it's super, super upsetting. And I did, there's an essay that's not in the book, but it's published in a wonderful journal called Gorse, where I was on a panel with Jamie Attenborough, the American writer, who's super funny and really cool. And I read a piece from this essay, and after she said to me, I think you're a political writer, and I said, I don't think that I am. And she said, well, if you're a woman writing about all the things that have happened to women in Ireland and you're writing about the female body in Ireland, how is that not political? And it actually kind of opened a door. I was still struggling with the book at that point, and it made me kind of think, yeah, maybe it is like that, and maybe the things that I'm saying will link up with other things that are broader and not just necessarily about me or my life.
That's how you could sort of make the argument that, you know, based on years of history, more or less, any woman writing, it's kind of, you know, it is political. And this idea that we're sort of like heartwarming and domestic and content, that's splitting us up, that's separating our stories. And it's funny, isn't it, how all of these women keep writing about terrible things that happen to women. Let's not link those up. Let's talk about the individual journey rather than saying this is part of a whole.
And I've said even more broadly, and not just about the essay, but I've said this in relation to the short story anthologies I've edited, which are all female, two of them for reasons of the Irish canon being very heavily skewed towards men and women being left out of it. So I decided rather than give out about that, I would do something. So I'd make books. And sometimes, you know, I know there are people, and I know there are Irish writers and Irish male writers who haven't read those books because they see it as a book full of 30 women, even though lots of them write short stories and lots of stories are very good. And some of them are by classic people like Elizabeth Bowen or Maeve Brennan. But there is a massive assumption made all the time about what the subjects that women write about, and that those subjects are twee or cosy. And they're about, you know, and I've said this many times on panels, that if it's about relationships or sex or love or families or death, it's kind of, it's domestic and it's lovely and they did a great job. But when men write about the subject, it's kind of human condition and it's much more philosophical and it's political and it's the global weight of the world stuff that men are actually taking on and women aren't. And it's like, but that's not, simply not true. We're all writing about those subjects. But I sometimes think that, and it'll be interesting to see what the response to Consolations is in terms of men. And I've heard from a lot of men who've been reading it, which is wonderful, because they're seeing that it isn't a book. It's by a woman, but it's not necessarily for women, even though there's a lot of stuff relating to femalehood, I guess, in the book.
But I guess in terms of it being a learning experience in a book of impact. Yeah. I'm not saying for a second, you know, I know all that. I found it, you know, enormously rewarding to read a book that's a real sort of, you know, a wealth and a nourishment. But I feel as though if you're a man who doesn't read many women and has a fairly easy, untroubled life, like, you need to read this book. There's information here that would be very useful to you.
It's funny. I find some people have been tweeting me about going, oh, I got your book, or I'm going to read your book. And I have to stop myself and go, hope you enjoy it. Because it's like, it's a little bit of a strap yourself in one. There's a lot of dark moments in this book. And there's lots of...
This is one of those things where I'm going to say, I love this. And you're like, that wasn't the book. That was something else. But do you write about repeal in the book?
Yes, I do.
Because I remember that being heartbreaking, but ultimately really euphoric. And this idea of all of those multitudes and the history being as a real sense of celebration, but also of everything that came before it. Yeah. And I think that is, I think I did enjoy it. Ultimately, it was sort of not... Yeah, I don't know if I'm allowed to want a happy ending, but it felt like a happy ending.
Yeah, and it's funny, somebody else, two other people have said to me, and I think it's in relation to one of the motherhood essay, somebody said to me that I was funny. And whenever people say that, it's just unusual when you write essays about such serious stuff. In some of my fiction, it's definitely different. But the repeal one was interesting because I wasn't going to write about that. But again, the book was coming to an end as I was out knocking on doors and helping as hundreds of other men and women were trying to get it over the line. And just found it was on my mind. And that 2 weeks before the referendum, I mean, every woman I know was like crying, not sleeping, drinking a lot more wine than usual, just trying to like wait for the day and find out that this would all be okay. And it was really, really stressful. So And then I remember, because I have a daughter and my daughter was asking me about it, I'm thinking, hopefully this will not be the case for you. And I write about my daughter in the book quite a bit, that I wanted it to be so different, but I wasn't going to be in there. And then I kind of felt, again, I'm writing a whole book and lots of it is about the body, not all of it. How can I not write about that movement and what's happened? But it was almost like every time I got to do the edits, things were changing and it was moving along. And even now the law has come in, but there's been a problematic case of a woman who's been refused an abortion, who's had a fatal fetal abnormality. And the law is not perfect by any stretch, but like I said, there's always been, there have been women around in Ireland who were doing this stuff in the 60s and 70s and beyond and before that, who were at a time when it was much harder to do it. It's almost easy for someone like me to do that, but there was a lot of women who come before me. In the same way with the writing as well and the anthologies, the women who got to be writers who were competing against men who didn't want to include them in their anthologies, didn't want to hold up their work, didn't want to talk about their work. And as long as women stop never doing that, I'm not going to let that happen. I am going to speak up. I am going to do something. I'm going to be active, not passive about it. I think that makes me really hopeful, I guess. So yeah, it had to be in there, I think. I wasn't going to at the start.
Maybe in the way that, you know, it's true of writing, that the more people do it, the more people coming up will see it can be done and it's important to do.
Yeah, and I think, again, like I've taught workshops with people and it can be like a whole variety of experience and what people want to do with their work. But it is confidence, and I see it much more with women. I mean, in lots of cases, like there's a wonderful Irish publisher, Tramp Press, run by two women called Lisa Cohn and Sarah Davis Goff. And Sarah has her own novel coming out, a really good novel about zombies in Ireland called Last One's Left Alive. And they have a submission policy where if you send them a submission and you say you don't read any women, they won't read your manuscript. But they said that even the confidence of people who approach them in terms of I'm a writer or I want to write, I'm trying to write, it's always a lot more men who are much more confident. And often it's women who are less.
But
it was like, ta-da, I've written a book and it's getting published. And I thought that was amazing.
Absolutely. The paragraph you read, Nora Zeal Huston, that we know women, the dreaming is the doing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I, like I said, didn't do it for years. And I realized that even times when you're not necessarily writing, you are thinking about it. And I'm trying to write a novel at the moment, and I haven't really been near it in the last few months because of kind of exhaustion and work and life and kids and everything else. And the more I didn't do it, whereas I had been in a daily process with the book, the more I didn't do it, the more the days went by and the more they clocked up. And I was looking in the rearview mirror going, God, that habit of writing I had every day is kind of gone. And part of me went, whew, maybe I don't have to do it again. Grant. And then another part of me went, no, you have to go back. But I got really afraid of going back and I got really nervous about it. And I went away very recently for 4 days to a retreat to see if I could climb back into it. I had bits and pieces of it done, all very in scraps, haven't a clue really what it is. But I did, and I got back into the habit, and it was kind of a relief because I really felt before Christmas, I don't know how I'm going to do this. I don't know what and I don't have a deadline or a pressure, which is great because I think that would finish me off altogether. But I got back into doing it in a way I realised that even though I wasn't writing, I figured out loads of things by just thinking about it occasionally, going, I've got to get back to the writing. But I did figure out things by not even not doing it. I interviewed Jeffrey Eugenides a couple of years ago, and I said to him, are you working on a new book? And he's like, yeah, I am. And I said, how's that going? How far are you in? And he's like, do you mean like the word count? And I said, yeah, are you far along? And he's like, oh no, I haven't written a word. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, oh no, I think about a book for a whole year in my head. I don't write a single word. And then I sit down and write it. And I was like, not even notes, notebook. He was like, nope.
That terrifying. Is terrifying, yeah. But quite comforting, because I do fall into that trap of feeling, I've got a weird Protestant work ethic for a Catholic maybe, but like I need to have something to show. And actually,
what if you didn't remember it though? And also, I do think, I don't know about you, but think sometimes you start off your day going, right, I'm going to write this, and then you start writing and your brain drags you off in a different way, and you're like, no, we're going over here and you're coming with me, and there's nothing you can do about that. So I wouldn't be able to do that. I think that I'd be end up going mad.
Do you ever enjoy writing? Do you ever have moments where you're like, yeah, this is nice?
Yeah, they're very rare though, I think. Mostly it feels like slog and work. When you think you're nearly finished something, it's good. When you can't figure out the problem of something, I find it really absolutely, it's soul destroying. You're just like, I don't know how to make this better. And there was an essay that was nearly in the book that wasn't, that I will go back to that. That was nearly there, and I didn't think it was. I needed my editor, but I will go back to that. But I tried a couple of different things with it, and I know it was also because I was racing against the clock, and that was the biggest thing. And sometimes you just need to put things aside. Mm. And one or two things have happened since that essay, because it's on a specific subject, that have happened now that I'm glad I didn't write it then, because two things I've discovered that are like, great, I can now put that in. But yeah, so away recently doing the novel, I had a really good day where I got loads and loads done. I figured out an awful lot of things, and it's the most, I think it's the busiest writing day I ever had. Then the next day I got practically nothing done. So that's, it is swings and roundabouts. You just, and you have to kind of write it out. But if you don't show up, which I hadn't been doing, there, you know, there'll be no words. And if you even write 100 words, 100 words are better than no words.
I do sometimes think with social media, in the way that in my head, I know it's not good for me. I never, ever, ever come off it. Oh, that was great. I really enjoyed that
terrible.
Mad half hour.
Yeah.
But sometimes on Instagram, you see, you'll follow, you know, hypothetically, I follow 1,000 people and maybe, I don't know, 30 or 40 of them at any given time on holiday. But it just, in my head, they turn into one giant person who's always like on the beach having the best time, not separate, you know, it's not something that someone's doing once a year. And in that way, I feel as though perhaps there's one enormous super successful person who's got like 3 books out a week.
Yeah.
Because when you're not writing and worrying about not writing, and you see that.
I know a couple of people have, I saw this actually recently on Twitter, a couple of people kind of saying, and I was having a DM chat with this young Irish writer who, she doesn't live in Ireland, again, because of our crazy rental situation and it's so expensive here. And she was saying it can be really, really hard to look online and see everyone with their book deal news and their exciting news. And my extract is here and I've got an agent. And I'd say that's really terrifying. I mean, we've all been at that point at different points. Or if you're having a terrible day and somebody's like, I just bashed out 2,000 words and you feel like a total idiot because you can't manage 20. But it's all like part of it.
You just check your bank balance online and someone's like, just sold my film rights.
And there'll always be that. And I mean, as we all know, persona is a big part of Twitter. Some of the people who are really, really funny that I know on Twitter who have met in real life are really, really quiet. I have made so many friendships, and I'm about to get into a WhatsApp book group with Catherine Angel and various other women about a book, actually an Anne Boyer book that we want to talk about. And this is the kind of stuff that happens.
Do you know which one you're starting with?
We're going to start with, I think, Garments Against Women, and then she has a new book out that we all are champing at the bit to get at, but it's not out till later on. But again, I see it all the time online that I see women who are so keen to connect with other women, to amplify, to hold each other up, to look out for people when people are having bad days or have had terrible experiences or have talked about their Me Too experiences. And I find there's loads and loads of good in Twitter, which can offset all of the horror show of it most of the time. And a lot of the reason I'm there is because a lot of the people I've met, and a lot of them happen to be women, including you.
Well, so. I think as well, you know, it's, the internet is only as good or bad as the people who use it. And I hope you don't mind me saying, because it is a bit cheesy, but you are, you know, actively making it a much better place than it was when you found it, which is of great power and value in your writing. And that's actually something that I think the way women communicate with each other online, and it does feel like a dark and difficult time in some respects now. There's lots of shouting and being drowned out.
That's why we have secret WhatsApp groups to give out about everybody.
Maybe the writing, it's books and it's poems and it's essays, but maybe it's also that.
Yeah, it'll sound like it's the biggest cliche in the world to kind of, you know, that art can save your life and art gives meaning to our lives and our existence. But it is. But at a time when things are feeling really, really bad, and people talk about, you know, self-care and going out for a walk and stuff, but I find it reading and dipping into something and even like picking a couple of poems if I don't have time to delve into, or I can't find the right book, or my head's melted and I can't think of the right thing to read. If you just read, words offer huge amounts of solace. And they did for me all those years I spent all that time in hospital. And anytime I was sick, I was always reading, because it didn't ever feel that I had a lot of very bad days. And some of those days were just really helped because of books and because of words and because feeling that you can climb into something and lock yourself away from the actual horrible trauma of your life on that particular day. But you can escape with words, and I've always found them that way. And again, I also, Twitter has been a place I found Anne Boyer because of Twitter, Roxane Gay because of Twitter. You find lots of people because it just takes someone snapping a picture of a book or mentioning something, and then people get to know what you like and go, oh, do you know what you'd like? And I do the same thing when with friends. I go, yeah, I think you really like this. So it's been wonderful. There's so many good things about it, not least finding brilliant new people who write wonderful books. You know, I've mentioned Roxane, I've mentioned like Olivia Sudich's book, Sympathy, which I loved recently. This is another thing that I found I returned in the last few years as I started to write, possibly as a way of not wanting to read fiction, because I used to read a lot of it, as I started getting back into reading more poetry. And there's just been incredible amounts of
Exposure is great as well, because it's nice and short.
It's nice and short, but also I think if anyone, and I say this to people who want to write, whether they decide they never want to be a poet, if you want to be a writer, you need to be reading all the time, but you need to be reading poetry. That's how you learn about words and sentence structure and rhythm. And all those kind of things.
And economy.
Less again,
economy.
There's been so many wonderful Irish writers. This is Eleanor Hooker. She lives in Tipperary. Martina Evans, We Can Talk Openly About Men, which is a super stealable title. A good friend of mine, Dearanie Grifa, who's a
gorgeous edition,
has published just a book called Lies, which is here somewhere, which is wonderful. And then there's people who, like Anne-Marie Nakura, and this is the most incredible collections about, again, takes on a lot of stuff about female bodies and mother and baby homes. And then you've got people who are doing this kind of stuff, which is like Anne Boyer, who's, I mean, it's kind of philosophical. It looks like prose. Some of it is kind of poetry. She's incredible. You should follow her on Twitter. She's got a new book coming out this year. And reading people like this kind of shows this is somebody who's utterly fearless, who doesn't care. Doesn't want to be called a certain kind of writer. Is has no truck with form. It's like, don't put me in boxes. And I really like those kind of writers who blur those lines. And lots of people are doing that with them.
Shall we finish on a poem? Is there anything you'd like to read?
Oh, let me think. Yes, absolutely. If I can find it, because it's used in the epigraph of Constellations. Yes, here. This is, I don't know if you've come across this writer, Liz Berry. This is called The Republic of Motherhood. And I used a line of this as an epigraph in the front of Constellations. I totally love this. And it also speaks to some of the things in Constellations. So it's called The Republic of Motherhood by Liz Berry. I crossed the border into the Republic of Motherhood and found it a queendom, a wild queendom. I handed over my clothes and took its uniform, its dressing gown and undergarments, a cardigan soft as a creature, smelling of birth and milk. And I lay down in motherhood's bed, the bed I had made but could not sleep in, for I was called at once to work in the factory of motherhood. The owl shift, the graveyard shift, feeding, cleaning, gloving, feeding. I walked home, heart sore, through pale streets, the coins of motherhood singing in my pockets. Then I soaked my spindled bones in the chill municipal baths of motherhood, watching strands of my hair float from my fingers. Each day I pushed my pram through frieze and blossom down the wide boulevards of motherhood, where poplars bent their branches to stroke my brow. I stood with my sisters in the queues of motherhood, the weighing clinic, the supermarket, waiting for its bureaucracies to open their doors. As required, I stood beneath the flag of motherhood and opened my mouth, although I did not know the anthem. When darkness fell, I pushed my pram home again by lamplight, wrote urgent letters of complaint to the Department of Motherhood, but received no response. I grew sick and was healed in the hospitals of motherhood, with their long closed isolation wards and narrow beds watched over by a fat moon. The doctors were slender and efficient. When I was well, they gave me my pram again so I could stare at the daffodils in the parks of motherhood, while winds pierced my breasts like silver arrows. In snowfall, I haunted motherhood cemeteries, the sweet fallen beneath my feet, Our Lady of the Birth Trauma, Our Lady of Psychosis. I wanted to speak to them, tell them I understood, but the words came out scrambled, so I knelt instead and prayed in the chapel of motherhood, prayed for that whole wild fucking queendom, its sorrow, its unbearable skinless beauty, and all the souls that were in it. I prayed and prayed until my voice was a night cry, sunlight pixelating my face like a kaleidoscope. It's incredible.
Huge thanks to Sinead. Constellations is out on April the 4th, published by Picador. It will get in your head like a song. It will stop you from ever taking your body or your life for granted. And it will make you kinder, more tender and more appreciative of everyone you love in your life. I'm Daisy Buchanan. Thank you so much for joining me for our paperback perving. You can find me on Twitter at NutRollerGirl and on Instagram at TheDaisyBee. Say hello, suggest some guests and watch out for shelfies. Visit our show page, acast.com/booked, for more information about our guests and a list of the books they've talked about. If you have any other queries about the podcast, you can email us at whybooked@gmail.com. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. Please do subscribe, rate us and leave a review. It's great to hear what you think and it helps other people find the podcast. I'll see you next time. For now, let's hope our future guests follow the instructions of Dr. Seuss. Fill your house with stacks of books in all the crannies and all the nooks.
Hold up. It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.